15 to 20 million jobs. I am your future.
Isn't it about time for a change?
We are national leaders.
AmericanWorkersRadio.com.
You're listening to American Workers Radio, a national network promoting American-made products with your host, Michael Blihash.
Well, welcome once again to another edition of American Workers Radio here on 860 AM. As you know, we serve Philadelphia and the entire tri-state area. And as always, I ask you to go to your telephone, invite family members and friends to tune in, because we have a very exciting broadcast today. We're going to ask you also to email the link so that people can listen live right now. Click on it and you'll go right to our broadcast. And you will receive an email update, a rebroadcast this afternoon. So do spread the word with us, and because this is a very special time in America. Today, joining us, we have several people, and we're going to have that second part of the interview with Christopher Scalia and Rich Loges. And we have with us Mark Andel, founder of the Made in America store. Remember, you can always get 100% American-made products simply by going to madeinamericastore.com. Also, Larkin Conley, small business advocate and SCORE mentor. Rich Loges, principal of RJL Technology Integration. Our engineer is Henry Chaplinsky, and I'm Michael Blihash, always pleased to be with you. And joining us today also is Curtis Ellis. As you know, he's a national journalist, a senior advisor to President Trump, and the executive director of the American Jobs Alliance. And we're always pleased to hear from Curtis, and we're going to be very pleased to hear what he has to say about the interview with Christopher Scalia. Before we get into anything else, I just would like to say that I think America's young people are on a positive change. For the 50 million people that we presently have in our school system, I think that we're going to see the ones that are in junior high, high school, and college stop towing the party line and do their own thing to benefit themselves in a very positive way. After what I've been seeing in the last few months going around to the different job fairs and all, people are really want change. And I think we're seeing a new generation of young people starting to think for themselves, doing things that are going to make themselves great and make all of us proud again. Everywhere I go, that's the message. And they're not really concerned who's bringing them the positive message. What I mean by that is they're not worried, these young people, about Democrats, Republicans, independents. They want to know how are they going to best lead their lives and make a better future for themselves, because it's not good to be dependent on anyone but yourself, especially if you have the ability to make your future great. And with all of that in mind, I'm going to turn first today to Mark Andel. Mark, I want to tell you, I heard great news in the state of New York that the governor signed a bill, and that is going to put a lot of good things on the Made in America list.
Yes. Yeah. How you doing, Mike, and all the listeners, our panel? Great times, Mike. So much accomplished this year. But, yeah, back when Ted Morton, as you know, introduced, the American Act as a law, and it was rolling good, and then politics with Mark Poloncarz, our county executive, played a part, and all of a sudden they lost 6-5 at the end. To see our governor step up and sign this act that basically if, you're building bridges or buildings, he's requesting that the steel and whatnot, anything over $1 million definitely comes from America. And you see the article I passed around, the Canadian said a little bit about, but it's really about putting yourself, your workers first, putting America first. I know Curtis is on and Donald Trump believes in. It's true. So to see this happen is more movement, Mike, in the right direction for what we believe in. Always take care of yourself, your area, and we will share work. But this is a great step in the right direction for the buyers, the people that really are in control and can make change, the buyers of the projects that are done in the state of New York, they're requesting that you shop American first.
Well, you know, Mark, what's very good about that is that it started now with all the bridge building and the road work. How about the other stuff that comes into the school systems, all taxpayer-supported programs, what Ted Morton was talking about,
yep,
in which they continue to talk about there in Erie County. I think we're going to see some positive changes. Our young people are now saying, my God, I'm in debt with all these great college degrees, but I don't have any job to go to. And I think a lot of people are going to start to reconsider it. I'm really pleased to see, even in the state of New Jersey, they're talking about more trade programs getting on the list of things to do. That's what we've been promoting for years. Unfortunately, it could have happened some years ago, but the first step is beginning, and we have to be grateful for that. I think there's a whole new spirit in the country.
And, Mike, being on a state level is awesome because that's where you want it. And, you know, where Ted Morton was fighting more on the county level. But this is a great, and they should lead, and every county and town should follow after this.
Well, you know, you're right. And, by the way, if you remember, Mark Polenkarsh was worried that some of what he was doing, if he agreed to that Made in America Act in Erie County, would be going against the state of New York. Now the governor is saying, well, okay, let's do it with steel. Now other people in Albany are saying, well, how about other things? We're beginning something very positive, and I don't think now that the ball is moving, we're going to be able to stop it. Thank you, Mark. I'm going to ask Larkin. Larkin, how is everything with you this week?
Good morning, Michael. How are you? Good morning to everybody, Curtis, Mr. Andel, Henry. Welcome. It's going well. I was supposed to be in Philadelphia this week, and Friday, as I was reviewing my wardrobe to see what I needed to pack to come up there, I checked the temperature, and I got on the Weather Channel, and I immediately sent a telegram to everybody saying, Larkin doesn't do snow anymore. So I am I'm sitting in 73 degrees. The sun is brightly shining, and I couldn't possibly be happier about my existence.
Well, Larkin, it was brutal in Philadelphia on Friday and got a little better on Saturday, but that's what Mark's been really putting up with for some time now.
60 inches of snow, Mike, in 10 days.
60 inches. Henry's smiling. He said, hey, that's what I like to hear.
I know that that's exactly what Mark needs to hear based on his business model, and I think that's great, but the only thing I can say to you, Mark, is that snow is a self-inflicted wound to you.
Everybody, I got to hide from all the women. They want to kill me.
I would love to have you down here in this state shaking up the entrepreneurial world. I have to tell you, and this is not on my Christmas list this year, but it's well worth mentioning. The strongest state economy in the country. Strongest state economy in the country. Florida. Number one in the country for strength of the economic background. And backbone, banking, debt, taxation, the whole 10 yards. Number one. And we're one of the few states in this wonderful union of ours that does not have a state tax. We don't have an income tax. So,
well, that maybe, says it all. That says it
maybe,
all.
Right. Maybe what that says is that it might be time to kind of think that we're taxing our people too much. I don't know. Sounds like a great indicator to me.
Well, you know, Larkin, I have to say, taxing the people in the past to be able to pay for them to receive all the unemployment and other benefits because they didn't have jobs may be coming to a halt. I think with some of the changes taking place in the country, we're going to see more jobs, more businesses feeling better about themselves. When I talk to the people, you know where we're located, the tourists come in, I always try to just see what they have to say. Most people are very, very good these days. They feel very happy. They feel that there's a future. There's something positive happening. And that's really what it is. Larkin, we're going to hear your Christmas list later in the broadcast. But now I want to turn to Curtis Ellis. How are you doing, Curtis?
Just great. Just great. It's a beautiful day in America, and I'm happy to be here. You know, it's funny what hearing everybody today. It's great hearing everyone today. The Made in America law in New York State is just a wonderful thing. I'm so happy to hear they figured that out, something that we figured out a long time ago. And I was thinking about the tax bill yesterday. The House is going to vote on it again this morning, and we're going to have a tax cut. And it works synergistically with the national security strategy that the president released the day before. We're finally calling out China for its illegal and destructive trade practices. And when you put that together with the tax bill, we're going to see the larger corporations and corporate America realizing that the best place to do business and invest is the United States, not China, not these other countries. This whole thing is about making a business environment hospitable to business, making a economic environment hospitable to business in America. And then you couple that with the fact that places like China and other places in the world are becoming less friendly to business. We're going to see this knock-on effect and a synergistic effect where the whole is equal to more than the sum of the parts. The tax cut in itself is a great stimulus for economic activity in this country, but you can add to it the fact that we're no longer going to give a free pass to countries importing stuff into our country from overseas that are being dumped, illegally subsidized, and getting off scot-free. It's going to make a lot more sense for businesses to make their investment decisions to look here and make it in America.
There's no more excuses. What you're saying, there's no more excuse to stay out of America.
That's right.
And that's why there is no more excuse for us not to return our schools, our colleges, our community colleges to the trade programs and to getting people into the skills. The most important thing that we can do is train our young people for what they are best at. As I mentioned a few times during past broadcasts, when we were young people, they always asked us, what do you think you'll be best at? Well, that question has to return, and that question has to be put on the top of the list of things to do, because our young people have ideas. Not every person wants to be a doctor or a lawyer. Some people want to do, you know, the technology work and the research work and the more quiet things to do. And that's what we have to do. And so much of what has happened in America is turning to, you know, machines, robotics, and everything else, people doing business on the internet. It's unbelievable. But if we had 50% of everything that was sold in the stores and on the internet American made, our problems would be solved. But we're flooded with overwhelming amounts of foreign stuff, so we cut our own throat, and now we have to heal it and get back to normal. With that, hey, I'm going to go to Dr. Loges. How are you, Rich?
Guys, good morning. I'm doing the Mr. Mom. Good morning, Curtis, to everyone. I'm doing the Mr. Mom thing today, Michael. So you want to talk about live radio? Today is hot live radio. This is hot mic everywhere. I'm chasing a kid around. Wife's out. Just moved to our new place, and we've got, for our listeners, we got part two today of my interview with the son of the late great Justice Antonin Scalia, Chris Scalia, which we'll get to in a moment. Just a couple of thoughts, guys, to unpack everything starting out here. A lot of good – see, Larkin, I don't care what age someone is. Eventually, Larkin and Joe got really smart, right? Because you guys figured out that living in cold is dumb. I mean, it is, right? It just is. My friends, family living in the Northeast, I love them all to death. But let's just be honest about it. Living in cold weather is dumb. So, you know, you guys did that. You came down to sunny state of Florida, Larkin, and I'm going to corroborate what he said, that the state of Florida, every year I read a study from George Mason University, which is a nonpartisan study. It's not blue, not red, not anything. And it looks at the financial insolvency health of all states. And Florida is the number one strongest state economically. Now, Curtis, here's the thing. I'll let our listeners make a determination on this, but in that same study, the top 13 strongest states economically, according to this study, top 13 all voted for the president. And in the top 25, 21 of them voted for the president. So is there a correlation there? I guess it depends on what side of the fence you're on, but I don't think it's accurate to say there's not any correlation. So, Larkin, I'm going to back him up on that. And Michael, one last point. Regarding our youth and our millennials. So this is like a bread and butter issue for me, as you guys know, because it's one of the things that I'm going to be talking a lot about in my book coming up, 10 Warning Signs Your Child is Becoming a Democrat. But the fact of the matter is, Michael, is that the millennials right now, they're the largest voting bloc in the country. And too many of the GOP politicians and the analysts and the pundits, you know, some of whom predicted Hillary Clinton would win 57 states, with all respects to them, Curtis, they really suck at selling politics, especially to the youth. Because instead of talking to millennials as they're dumb and they're this and they're that, we need to be engaging them in politics. Because that generation, Michael, as they're growing up, they're sympathetic to socialism because they graduate with the debt. It's hard to find a job. And then you have the Dem politicians go and say, hey, let's have a bunch of free stuff. You know, and let's tax this and tax that, but just not my money. The tax reform that's going through right now, Curtis, that money is our money. It's being returned back to us. Government doesn't have anything, guys. It gets from the people. And right. The people who need it the most, working families, small businesses, the people who need it the most are going to benefit the most. That's who's going to benefit from this, Michael. The people who need it the most are going to benefit the most. So I see that as a major victory. And finally, the GOP can hang their hat on a big win. So that's our money. It's going to all come back to us right now.
Now, we want to hear.
Are going to benefit the most.
Dr. Logis, we want to hear your interview, and then we're all going to come back and offer some thoughts on it.
Yeah, guys, we're back here with part two of my interview with Chris Scalia, the son of the late, great, venerable Justice Antonin Scalia. As an originalist, you interpret based on the text, based on what the framers and the founders intended, versus a legal philosophy of the Constitution being, and these are my words, a inorganic, tofu-eating, living and breathing, organic Constitution. Your father very clearly was against that way of interpreting the Constitution. Is that fair, would you say, for me to say that?
That is more than fair. His perception of the living Constitution was that it put far too much power in the hands of judges. If the meaning of the Constitution changes according to the times, then who is the final judge of what the beliefs of the times are? Obviously, it's the Supreme Court justices in that context. But really, as my father argued, the arbiter of beliefs of time should really be the people through their legislators, not unelected justices on the Supreme Court. So originalism, on the other hand, my father liked to refer to this as the dead Constitution approach, or he would jokingly put it that way, or better yet, the enduring Constitution, which was that the meaning of the Constitution did not change. And it was up to justices to determine what the original public meaning was of the Constitution. That required some research, of course, but judges were better capable of doing that sort of historical research and analysis than they were acting as philosophers or metaphysicians determining what the spirit of an age was.
Your father made that so clear when I saw him speak, when he said that the Constitution, and I'm paraphrasing this a little bit, but I think I'm pretty close to the exact quote, where he said the Constitution is not a document of change. It is a document to resist change, to make it harder. And
right.
And he always gave, and I'd like for you to do this, please. It's I think it's an hilarious thing that your father had said. Remember the Prego sauce comparison that he made? Can you tell our listeners for that? This is a good one.
My father likes to compare the living Constitution approach to jurisprudence to an old 80s television commercial for Prego tomato sauce. And in that commercial, a woman is cooking pasta sauce, really just reheating it. Her husband sees what she's up to and says, "What, you bought this store-bought sauce? You're not making it yourself? What about the oregano?" And the woman says, "It's in there." "Oh, yeah, what about the garlic?" "It's in there." "Well, what about the olive oil?" "It's in there." And my dad says that we've got that kind of a constitution now. "You want a right to an abortion? It's in there. You want a right to die? It's in there. Whatever is good and true and beautiful, it's in there. Never mind the text. That's irrelevant. If you like it, it's in the Constitution." I always loved that way of approaching it because it was, I didn't study law myself, but I did watch a lot of TV, and I liked pasta sauce. So I got that. I got that way of describing it.
He was very fond of that comparison. And, you know, and I remember also when I heard him speak, and he said the Constitution is a legal contract. And I got to thinking years later, okay, legal contract is subject to some interpretation, sure, but the words inalienable rights don't leave a hell of a lot of room for interpretation. And mm-hmm. I always thought that I always associated that with the way your father talked about the enduring Constitution, and that if you want a right, do it the democratic way. Go pass a law.
Right.
Because that was another thing I'd like for you to talk about here, that your dad always, the thing about how our ancestors used to say, if you want something, pass a law. And then your dad, remember what he always said? He always said that now when people disagree with things, they say, that's unconstitutional.
Yeah, he was concerned that the people, that Americans were viewing the court in an unhealthy way. And they saw that, rightly recognized that justices, really beginning in the, well, especially in the 60s, were beginning to, as I said earlier, assume power that really belonged in the hands of legislators. So people recognized that, even if they wouldn't put it quite this way, judges were speaking for them instead of just interpreting the law. And my father pointed out that this is a big reason why we have such heated confirmation battles now. As long as judges become de facto legislators, the people who actually are legislators, senators, and the people who vote for those legislators, the voters, are going to make sure that confirmation battles become basically mini plebiscites on in which they can express how they want judges to vote, which political opinions judges should have, and things like that. It, you know, really didn't used to be that way. Right now, judges barely eke by confirmation votes. My father was confirmed to the court 91-0. But it didn't take long for things to really get very heated and very controversial because people and senators recognized that confirmation battles were basically fights over major democratic or major issues that better belonged in the democratic realm but weren't there anymore.
Chris, let me ask you on a broad point about that. And again, folks, we're with Chris Scalia, the son of the late Justice Antonin Scalia. The book out, Scalia Speaks, Reflections on Law, Faith, and Life Well Lived. Chris and Justice Scalia's former law clerk, Edward Whalen, put together and edited a collection of speeches that Justice Scalia gave over the years. I'm going to try to say this, Chris, and please, I hope I say it as respectfully as I can, because a Supreme Court justice passing away in an election year is historically extremely rare. You have to go all the way back to 1940 with President Franklin Roosevelt, and I made sure to do my due diligence and check that fact. There have been some retirements along the way, but a justice passing away in an election year, extremely rare. So while I don't particularly want to get into you know, whether you're a Trump or Clinton person, but what I do want to ask you about is any Supreme Court justice who would pass away in election year, it's an unfortunate thing, you know, losing a member of the court. But I think that your father's passing and being such an influential figure on the court that I felt like during the campaign leading up to the election, certainly your father's influence is immeasurable in his life. But I came to thinking afterwards that even in his passing, his vacancy clearly, in my opinion, not taking a side, I'm just saying what I think happened, his passing clearly, at least in some part, and I think a large part, influenced the outcome of the election. Because those who ascribe to your father's way of how he interpreted the Constitution, it was a really, really big deal for us. Am I on the right track, you think, saying that in his
passing? Based on polling that happened afterwards, after the election, I think that's true, that the court was a huge issue. And I think that I suspect that a lot of people a lot of conservatives obviously wanted to make sure that my father's legacy was preserved as much as possible. And I think his death kind of really made people more aware of just how significant he was on the court and what a clear voice for originalist and textualist principles he was over the course of his career, you know, over 30 years on the court, just under 30 years on the court. And so I think it makes sense to me that for a lot of people, a lot of Republicans and conservatives, he was whoever his replacement would be was an important issue.
Yeah, I just, you know, you look in prior campaigns and the Supreme Court, and granted there was a full 9 seats, but you know, you go back to the 08, 012 campaigns and the Supreme Court, just my recollection of it, just wasn't really an issue. You know, it wasn't mm-hmm. something that came up regularly. But then with your father's passing, it was a talked about almost every day campaign issue. And of course, with the election of President Trump and now Justice Neil Gorsuch, your father and Justice Gorsuch also, I was going to ask if you could talk about this for a moment, they also had a kinship as well and a friendship, right?
Well, they went fishing together, and you know, they knew each other. Yeah, from what I know, my father was certainly an influence on Justice Gorsuch. One of the speeches I can't remember whether we included it in this collection, but Justice Gorsuch, when he was a student, heard my father speak at law school. So he definitely admired my father and has been remarkably gracious to my mother and my family, really since his nomination.
And I heard Justice Gorsuch say the same thing that your father did at his nomination hearing when the president nominated him, that a good judge doesn't always personally agree with the legal outcome. And in looking at Justice Gorsuch's legal philosophy, my interpretation of his approach was that he very much approached in his jurisprudence philosophy was really quite similar to your father. And in reading about Justice Gorsuch since assuming that ninth and crucial tie-breaking seat, that he's already carved out quite a streak of autonomy and independence on the court. And I thought, well, that's perhaps Justice Scalia would be quite happy and proud to know someone he influenced greatly assume that ninth seat.
Right, and obviously that doesn't mean that they would agree on every issue or anything like that, but I think their basic principles and approaches are similar. Justice Gorsuch is proud to say that he's an originalist and a textualist. And what you said about, you know, not liking every decision, I mean, we saw during Justice Gorsuch's confirmation hearings that the Trucker case that he came under attack for, I think, is a good example of a textualist approach. If you remember that one, he interpreted a law by the letter, basically, and determined that a trucker who was in a very uncomfortable situation was not protected by the law. And he came under attack basically because the trucker should have been protected by the law. And Justice Gorsuch's basic stance was, well, then the law should have been written better. but it's not his job as a judge or now as a justice to rewrite the law.
What a novel idea that we don't have judicial activists, huh? That's something. That's something, isn't it? Again, folks, we're with Chris Scalia here, the book Scalia Speaks, Reflections on Law, Faith, and Life Well Lived. And I just want to say, Chris, being on here with you and having Ed Whalen, your father's former law clerk, my compliments on a really astounding collection and diverse assortment of your father's speeches here. I want to ask you to close on a story I know you've given before, but I think it's I never tire of hearing it. And for all of our listeners, there are numerous interviews with Chris talking about the book and his family life on YouTube, and we'll get to a moment, Chris, where our listeners can get the book. But would you mind to indulge us all, please, and tell the story again about when you introduced your dad at your high school graduation?
Spoke at my high school graduation, and I had the honor and privilege of introducing him. And obviously, I wanted to impress all of my classmates and all of their parents and relatives. So I delivered a pretty good speech. I was funny. I told the facts about my dad's life and stories about growing up with him, stuff like that. And I really thought I had done a pretty darn good job. And all that was left was to announce him, to say his name. So I said, "Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Justice Anta." And I just totally butchered his first name, Antonin. Keep in mind, as his son, I usually didn't call him by his first name or even by his nickname, Nino. So I didn't have a whole lot of practice in pronouncing his first name. And also, in my defense, President Reagan mispronounced his first name when he announced his nomination in 1986. But it was still pretty embarrassing to mispronounce my own father's first name in front of all my classmates. I'm not really sure how many people noticed it, because if I had noticed it, I would have made fun of myself. If I were one of my friends, I would have made fun of me for the rest of my life. But nobody really teased me about it afterwards, except I think my dad did, because after I introduced him, he got up and thanked everybody there. And when he came to thanking me, he pretended to check his notes to make sure he was getting my name right.
Well, your dad, another trait I think that I just discerned from the book in the collection of speeches, your dad struck me as, aside from his sense of humor and his humility, that he was a forgiving man. And as a devout Catholic, it was very obvious how important his faith was just in day-to-day life. And God bless the family you have. 9 children with your dad and mom, wife, Maureen. And did I get the number correct earlier last week? I think I said 35 grandchildren.
It's we're now at 39 and one 39. Grandchild. So, yeah, it's growing. Impressive.
Amazing.
Numbers.
Amazing. I would have, I want to be a fly on the wall during, politics is so, as you see it, it's so heated. And unfortunately, there is a lot of the tribalism right now. And I try to balance that way of thinking with what your dad said: attack the ideas, not the person. But man, I'd love to be a fly on the wall for those holiday political dinners.
To be honest,
you probably have stuff. Food fights. You got stuff flying all over the place, I bet, at those dinners.
Well, politics didn't really enter into much. I mean, we of course we talked politics, but probably no more or less than most families. We had plenty of other things to talk about. But I miss him being at them. They're less fun without him, that's for sure.
Well, if I may say, Chris, in conclusion here, and I'm sorry to embarrass you and your siblings and your mom, Maureen, for saying this, but I really do believe that your father is an American hero. I think his influence, we don't quite realize yet just how profound it was. And he truly was a historic figure. And he was as brilliant a legal mind, I think, that as any we've ever seen. And in addition to that, if your dad hadn't been a judge and an attorney and a Supreme Court justice, even though he talked about writing being so difficult and so challenging, his love for it is something else that really jumped off the pages in the collection of the speeches.
I agree. He was a great speaker, a great writer. And one of the speeches in this collection is he describes the writing process and how he learned the hard work that writing took and all the hard work he put into it. And I think it clearly shows from his legal opinions, of course, but also these speeches.
And again, everyone, Chris Scalia here with us, the son of the late Justice Scalia. The book is Scalia Speaks, Reflections on Law, Faith, and Life Well Lived. Chris, it is truly an honor to have you on with us. Where can our listeners get the book?
Well, they can buy it at ScaliaSpeaks.com. That has some links for purchasing it, or they can just go to Amazon. It's usually on sale there. It's available at Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, and independent bookstores as well. So it's available hardcover right now. Also, a Kindle version is available, and you can buy the audiobook, too.
And you narrate the audiobook, is that right?
I do. I narrate. I read my father's speeches, and Justice Ginsburg reads her foreword.
That's wonderful. That's great. Chris, thank you so much for being
on.
Thank
you, Rich.
A Merry Christmas.
Thank you for your kind words. I appreciate it.
Our pleasure, and a Happy New Year to you and your family. And thank you so much for coming on. Again, folks, Scalia Speaks, Reflections on Law, Faith, and Life Well Lived. We were with Chris Scalia. Thanks, everyone.
Well said. Great interview. Thank you for doing that. And it's good to have a great interview like this, especially around this holiday season, because that's what it's all about. Family. That's a lot of grandchildren. Wow, I love hearing that. That was
good. Well, you know, Michael, as a follow-up, just related to what we spoke about, you know, as I mentioned in the interview, the Supreme Court was really a prominent issue in 2016, and that's because the president drove the issue, because it was a major issue for voters. The thing is, though, there were essentially two segments of voters, the kind of justices they wanted. You know, our segment, I mean, I'm speaking for me, I wanted a justice who's more in of the philosophy and approach as a Justice Scalia. And the other side essentially wanted the living, breathing Constitution type of justice. And it harkens back to something that I say on the show so often, which is what President Obama said in 2009 to a room full of Republicans and essentially to the whole nation when he said elections have consequences. And he was right, and he was correct about that. And the challenge for the GOP with that, when it comes to elections have consequences, is that now what's essentially happened post Trump election is the GOP needs to understand that the Democrats now are going to, they always turn out, they always come to vote, but they're really fired up, Curtis, right? They're really fired up. So you know, elections have a consequence, and one of the positive ones for us was Justice Gorsuch post-election. So they do have consequences, and I just, for those who don't have the book Scalia Speaks, I cannot more highly recommend a book for the holiday season. Even if you don't agree with a single opinion of the justice, you're going to love the writing and the humor, I promise.
And as Larkin said, it's also available on audio.
I bought the audio, Michael, and started listening to it instantly. And I likewise. I two comments. First of all, Antonin Scalia had an incredible sense of humor. That is one funny, funny man. I would also say that Chris, I mean, he looks at the lights out of it. I would also say that Chris has a future in doing audiobooks. He is doing a phenomenal job. He gave me a whole new look on the Second Amendment and where his father was coming about that Second Amendment and how that amendment fits in our Constitution and certainly for our people. But the most incredible feeling I had when I started to listen to that book was the foreword was written by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and she read the foreword, and she read it with heart. And it makes you sit and say to yourself, how can two people so polar opposites in their political and scriptural belief in the Constitution be as close of friends as the two of those were? How could they help each other write their opinions? And it's just incredible. It's a lesson that everybody in Washington, D.C. ought to read and learn about. And if we could get Ruth Bader Ginsburg to get on here, there's something to be learned by the relationship that they had, because I'm telling you, folks, those two were in complete juxtaposition to each other. I mean, you couldn't get further apart than the both of them were. But when she spoke about that man, there was such an enormous amount of love in her voice, and you could hear it.
Curtis, what did you think of the interview?
I thought it was terrific. It highlighted that there's really a difference. There's the big split in the country and in the philosophy, governing philosophy, is those who believe in the Constitution as written and believe in our government, a form of government as set out in the Constitution, and those who believe it's all up for grabs. You can read into it what you want. We don't need to have Congress approve laws. We can simply have a pen and a phone wielded by an executive, or have bureaucrats in the bowels of some faceless building, nondescript building somewhere in the federal gulag, churning out rules and regulations with the power of law. And that's essentially what we have now, an out-of-control government. And we have a judiciary, which in many cases is similarly out of control, beyond accountability. And that's the big, that I think is the essential contradiction and the essential split in government. And that's what I took away from that. Antonin Scalia, all those who called him old-fashioned or cranky or whatever, he simply believed that a word is what it is, and a document, or the founding document of this country, has to be taken for what it is, and that the Constitution is probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 pages, maybe a dozen pages. It is not an entire wall of law books of decisions and interpretations that have just grown like kudzu in the summer heat. Others believe that that's what the Constitution is, that the Constitution consists of just a wall of books detailing the different interpretations that have been made over all these years.
Well said. And Mark, how did you look at the interview?
Yeah, no, I appreciated it. I'm about to get that book, or sometimes I do the audio. You can listen to it. But Rich, great job. Just asking the questions. He seems like a great, great person himself. The son, but to be son of a judge with so much power and had made so much change, I think it's awesome. Listening, with you, Curtis, involved with the president and whatnot, I sometimes wonder how, lately the FBI got so corrupt. All these things going on in the Department of Justice and the IRS and the media we talk about, how they're one-sided. These good people that existed, it gives you hope and faith that there's more good people. But how, Curtis, with this FBI going on, and just wanted to touch on that, but the corruption in there, how did we get here, where these large organizations that we trust got to this corruption?
Well, we got here by not paying attention. Starting back in more than 100 years ago, Congress empowered these executive agencies to create law out of whole cloth. They'll pass a law, the Congress will pass a law with broad outlines. We want to decrease air pollution, and we will leave it up to the Environmental Protection Administration to determine how to do that. And then you've got 10,000 bureaucrats beavering away, creating regulations saying how they're going to stop air pollution and defining what air pollution is, and whether it's toxic gases emitted from some chemical plant to carbon dioxide. These rules with the force of law just start proliferating without any further action or review by Congress. And the same thing happens in the judicial branch. Madison versus Marbury gave the Supreme Court the power to strike down laws that it determined to be unconstitutional, but from there, we've somehow gotten to the point where a judge sitting in Honolulu decides that the president's action on immigration law is somehow does not need to be followed. I mean, this is just a bizarre turn of events.
And that's why the people want change. They want this ended. You know, everybody, each year, Christmas lists are made by the dozens, but there's always one presented by our well-known Larkin Connolly. Larkin, can I ask you to give us a few points from your Christmas list for this year?
I'd be more than happy, Michael. I wanted to add a little something to what Curtis just said. It's an indictment of the lack of to answer Mark's question, a lack of term limits. I find an incredible number of times that Congress falls asleep at the switch. And I think it's because they've lost sight of what the switch is and where it is and what they're supposed to be doing. And we've seen so many cases of it of recent in the last 15 years. It's incredible. But I sat on Santa Claus's lap about a week ago, and I gave him my list. Unfortunately, Santa Claus has a great memory, and he said, well, a lot of the things that you mentioned there were on last year's list. And I said, yeah, because you didn't bring them to me. That's why they're on the list. Listen, I told Santa, forecasters, economic forecasters are increasingly optimistic that the U.S. economic expansion could continue beyond 2020. Wouldn't that be great? Beyond the 2020 presidential election. And it's all of this aided by the Republican legislation and tax legislation that we just passed yesterday. We have to repass again today. We won't get into that techno. All lead towards really great economic expansion in the next 4 or 5 years, and there should be no reason why Congress should ever get in the way of that. But I have two wishes to Santa Claus as it relates to that economy. I requested that this expansion creates a flurry of small business startups, giving that Made in America movement that have generated here an incredible shot in the arm and to grow our manufacturing sector. A rich, sound economy is the environment that all good, solid entrepreneurs look for. So I hope for that. I also, to cut it short and not get into this, but, when the American consumers can confronted with a good economy, economic expansion, it builds consumer confidence. And the downside to that is that this confidence creates credit spending delinquencies. So on the other hand, as I want this to continue, I hope and I wish for to Santa that the economic growth continue, but that be coupled with very responsible spending on the part of the American consumer. We talked about term limits. That was my second wish. I won't give up on term limits until they are a reality. The argument for term limits is compelling. The one against term limits is very, very weak. If you're against term limits, you say that elections are term limits. And that might be a legitimate argument, as far as I'm concerned, if we didn't have elections that had 35% turnout. See, you have to remember, the lower the turnout, the easier it is to control the outcome. So the sooner we get term limits, the sooner we build a Congress with the future of this country as their primary concern. The sooner we establish a nonpartisan Congress, the sooner we begin to solve our problems and take advantage of our opportunities.
Wow, beautiful wish list. Wow, Santa must be very pleased.
And the last one, well, he was, and he said he was going to work on it, is, I want to bring us collectively, this country, a president who is a maverick, an unconventional one that's appropriate, and a president that acts presidential when it's necessary. Somebody has failed to sit down with our current president and tell them, listen, his policies, I agree with many of them, and I think the reaction to the American economy and the American voter is all due to these policies. He just doesn't sell them very well. Leadership's an art as well as a science, and someone needs to school our president on what people need from their leaders, and that's the big problem with Trump as I see it right now. By the way, while our president is in that schooling environment, I think he should be in the classrooms flanked by Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, because all three of them need to learn how to be leaders. Chuck Schumer is probably one of the most toxic politicians I have ever run into in my life. And how he gets reelected is a testament to the probably 19% turnout that they have, and it's probably his staff that reelects him. And quickly, now, I talked to Santa, and I said, Santa, please bring Michael Bleihaus, a 2018 economy that grows its manufacturing sector and its manufacturing base by at least 25%.
Thank you, Larkin. And he smiled and said, it'll happen this year.
He said so. I asked Santa to bring Mark Andel, a national initiative sponsored by the U.S. Department of Education that brings vocational education back to our school systems on a nationwide basis. This should be the second to the last thing that the DOE does. The last thing they should do is to find jobs in the states for all of the bloated staffers as they dismantle this useless agency. So, Mark, get ready for a national initiative that brings vocational education back to your school systems.
Excellent. Thank you, Larkin.
I have Santa to bring Rich, a bestseller, an absolute number one New York Times bestseller, and a blog that vaults into the top 10 national popular blogs. So, Rich, get ready. Santa's bringing it. I asked Santa, you know, Curtis has been around so much, I felt compelled to get him up. I asked Santa to bring Curtis a worldwide platform to help direct our economy away from nation building around the world by building up everybody else's economy at our economic expense. America needs to be a participant in the world economy and not a dumping ground for every other country's manufacturing base. And nobody we know can sell that better than Curtis, and I'd like to see him get a platform to be able to do that. And last but not least, oh, my dear, dear Henry, you are facing the best opportunity that your hometown has ever seen to win a Super Bowl. I told you to count on Nick Foles. I know he had a subpar weekend last Sunday and only threw four touchdown passes. But I'm telling you, Uncle Nicky can do this. Please, Santa, bring my dear friend Henry a Super Bowl trophy.
Yeah, let's do that.
Merry Christmas, everybody, and Happy New Year.
Hey, Larkin, very pleased. Now, I'm going to ask each and every one of you if you would bring us a New Year's list of resolutions for next Wednesday's broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, as you can see by the clock on the wall, it's getting to that time. I'd like to say Merry Christmas. Po polsku wesoły świąt. Feliz Navidad, Bon Natale. However you say Merry Christmas, may this be a great Christmas for you and yours. Please go out and spread the word about our campaign and make your New Year's resolution the best that it can be to support American workers. As we sign off, I'm going to ask everybody to give their wish, 30-second wish, beginning with Mark.
Oh, I hope all our listeners and our crew buys Made in America products to make this country strong. But I want to wish our whole panel here Merry Christmas and our listeners Merry Christmas. Enjoy time with your family.
Thank you. And Curtis.
I wish everyone a Christmas filled with love and gratitude.
And Dr. Logis.
Merry Christmas to everyone. Thank you so much for our listenership. And thank you again to Chris Scalia for coming on.
Thank you much, everyone. Larkin, Mark, Curtis and Rich and Henry Chaplinsky, thank you all. Kindly spread the word. You will receive a copy of today's broadcast a little later on this afternoon. Make sure you send it out. You hear the sincere voices of our panel members and our guests. Please do spread that word as you're celebrating your Christmas holidays with family and friends. Once again, Merry Christmas. Vesoishvilen. Until this Saturday at 11 or next Wednesday at 11, have a very merry holiday.
Merry Christmas, guys.